This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the RPM Subteam for URS Documents call on Wednesday, the 11th of July, 2018. Attendance for today's call will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? I know that Brian is only on the audio bridge, but hearing no further names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it over to Brian Beckham. Please begin.
Thanks. This is Brian. I apologize. I'm in the airport, so there may be some background noise. Barry, I don't know if you wanted to try to walk us through, only because I, like I say, I'm in the airport. What I did, just for everybody's information, is I went through the list of topics chart that Barry sent us a couple of days ago, and I've noted where it looks like most of the places where we had identified information to be gathered, and I was just recalling that that was the initial purpose of this subteam, was to identify sources of data that would help inform the work of the full working group and the other subteams. And so I went through this chart and made notes in the margins where it looked like, I would say, about 80% or more of the items we had identified were covered. A lot of that was, we had referred questions, if you remember, over to the provider survey, the practitioner survey, et cetera. There were a few places where I had made notes, I want to say maybe a dozen or so, where there was still some work to be done by our subteam. I think most of those, frankly, are pretty easy. So one thing I was hoping we could get from today's call would be volunteers just to help tick off those remaining to-do items. Then we can look at producing a summary of our findings for the full working group. And I know there was a discussion in Panama about whether there was utility in continuing work in subteams, which is, seems to have been pretty efficient so far. And so there would be a question for us and for the working group to decide whether in its current iteration, the document subteam, or in a different iteration with additional call for volunteers, it's useful to try to take some of the summaries that we've gotten from the different subteams and start to pull those together into policy recommendations. Does anyone have any thoughts or comments on that?
Brian, this is Barry. I'm not hearing or seeing any hands thus far, so if you don't mind, I'll take the reins and I can walk the group through what was sent to the list as part of the agenda.
That'd be great. Thanks, Barry. And I'm sorry, I'll do my best to try to find a quiet place to sit down. I'm just kind of in transit at the moment, and I'll jump in with my notes to complement your walkthrough of this.
Great. Thank you. Okay, so fortunately, everybody on the call is in the Adobe Connect room. I see Rebecca will be joining us shortly as well. Some of these documents are going to be difficult to follow along in the Adobe Connect room because there's basically links to other documents. So it might be best if you review through them, especially the one that's being viewed now, the consolidated URS document. On your own personal computer, it'll be easier to see the track changes as well as comments out to the side. So just a hint of background on how we got here. First and foremost, we had a subgroup subteam meeting prior to Panama, and that was where I first presented some of the new data and analysis that we had collected over the last several months after this subteam had identified some of those data sources. For example, an analysis on the responses as well as Professor Teshnet's coding research as well. And all of those combined help us essentially check the list off of what data that we had collected and analyzed. And so the intent of this updated consolidated URS discussion document that's presented in the Adobe Connect room is an attempt to create an inventory of what we have and what we and what is still outstanding. So I'm quickly going to, in a minute, run through an example just to give you an idea of how these four documents are linked together. And after that, then we can start to have a discussion about what other tasks this group needs to perform, or how they should go about further gleaning some of the, you know, making sense of the data and analysis as it relates back to the suggested topics that we have structured in this table. So I believe, you know, it was late last year when the larger working group was working through all of the rewriting the charter questions. And that's really the nexus of this document and what the first four columns are about. Once we did divide into subteams, then the fourth column, which is labeled data sources, was added. And that's where this particular subteam was formed and identified the data. Then I think towards the end of last year, there was some discussions about what components of URS might be shifted to phase two or not. And while that's still outstanding, staff had went ahead and took the initiative to go ahead and start collecting some of these identified data sources and putting together some of the analysis. And then the last thing I'll say, there are two things I'm going to say before I get into a walkthrough of this. That the meeting that this subteam had prior to Panama was just a presentation of some of that data, and there was a lot to digest there. And it was it didn't have its connection back to the suggested topics in the table, and thus another reason why I created the inventory. And then the secondary component after we review through this is you can see it over on the top right, or the bottom right of the Adobe Connect room. There are five high-level questions that I believe Heather had suggested that the working group consider when deliberating on different issues of these suggested topics. And we'll probably want to circle back to these when either this group or the larger working group, however it's decided, when we start to review things like the complaint, for example, that we have these five high-level questions in mind when the group starts to deliberate on them. And so we'll come back to that. All right, so basically on page three of this consolidated URS discussion document, as I mentioned, this table is broken down into various sections by a higher level topic, which is basically the complaint, the notice, the response, standard of proof, defenses, remedies, appeal, any overlapping process steps, cost, language, abuse of the process, education and training, and a few others down at the very bottom. So when we look at the first section of the complaint and the general subtopics, or, you know, any data that we can collect or discussion around the standing to file, grounds for filing, the filing period, and administrative review. So when this subteam had met, and I believe it was towards the end of February that we had started to finalize or have a final identification of these data sources, what I've gone and done now is created a redline edits to each one of the sources that were identified, and like I said, try to create this inventory to where we can find it. So, for example, in the first section, the complaint, you know, we identified three sources of data for this section A. The first was from the providers subteam because we were aware that They would be reviewing through the rules and procedures, and there would be topics or of discussion over there as it relates to the administrative review, for example, or from the practitioner sub-team. This group identified it'd be interesting to understand the qualitative experiences about what they're seeing as it regards to standing, grounds, and filing. And so now under each one of those, then there are sub-bullets about the exact location of the data and analysis. And the idea here is that as we're walking through these and you see a pointer to this data source, then the group should move to that data source, understand the data and analysis behind it, and use that for deliberations of any potential, you know, are there issues to consider, are there possible recommendations, et cetera. So just to complete this example, again, the ask here was from the providers, the administrative review stats pass or fail. What we identified and the sub-bullet that I put here is specifically responses and notes, URS provider questions, page 11, rows 30 and 31, and forum was the only one that had responded back to that, and there were 22 cases didn't pass the administrative review. So I'm going to change the AC room to go over to the responses and notes document so that we can look at those particular rows. And fortunately,
Barry and everyone, this is Brian. Can I make a quick comment or observation?
Please go ahead, Brian.
Barry, this is really great. This is, you and I had discussed in Panama doing this and you beat me to it. So this is really helpful to see where particularly in the providers and practitioner surveys, we had responses that were, areas we flagged for potential documents that would help inform the working group. But I just wonder, it's a question, if it's worth kind of just quickly running through the chart itself to look at the areas where we've completed our task in identifying a source. In this particular instance, we say that's the provider survey, and then we say we have responses. And then once we do a pass through that to identify the places where we have still a little bit of work to do on our part, then go through it a second time and do this kind of, let's say, substantive run through to say, what does the provider response question on page number 11, row 30 and 31 actually say? And does that make sense? In other words, to kind of go through on a procedural level first and then look at the substance at a second pass. The only reason I suggest that is I'm a little mindful of if some of these, I think we can kind of get into interesting substantive discussions. And I would hate for us to kind of not at the end of this call have gone through and see the few places where we have a little bit of work left to do and what we've done and then what we want to do in terms of substantive recommendations. Just a question for everyone.
Thank you, Brian. And I don't see any hands as of yet. And I think that's precisely what we're going to do. What I'm doing now is just trying to provide an example to understand the linkage between the documents. And then, yes, I was going to do that high-level overview of our table so we can identify what we have, what we don't have, or whether we even still need it or not. And then we can circle back and dive deeper into the substantive discussion.
Excellent. Well, sorry for the interruption in that case.
No problem. The document that you now see in the Adobe Connect room is a table compilation of the provider's subteam. And Ariel and the members of that team did an excellent job of essentially inventorying the rules and procedures and supplemental rules from the providers. And when that inventory was performed or created, then they also identified proposed questions, either questions that they determined on their own or, for our case, some of the questions that we had passed over to them. The next three columns are essentially responses from the three providers, and then there's a last column for any additional information that may have been there. So kind of going back to what our ask was, again, it was done at a very high level, but from the providers, you know, what stats or, you know, kind of pass-fail stats have you seen from an administrative review? And so, for example, here, ADN-DRC said there were more than two cases. If they failed the administrative review, they are displayed as withdrawn on their site. Forum had come back and said there were 17 cases with a little bit of substance. And then NFSD had also said that there were three cases that didn't fail the review. So that's kind of an example of the links between these. And just for sake of completeness, I will show you one other one that goes back to the staff. Actually, I'm going to show you two others just so that you understand. A little bit further down of the three data sources, there was, so again, from the practitioners, a qualitative experiences about what they are seeing in regards to standing grounds and filing period. So having gone through the practitioner survey, I found a couple of survey questions that are identified on pages 21 through 22 and 28. And so then the same kind of scenario applies here, that on page 21, the question was, do you believe that the submission or declaration of a specimen of current use in commerce should be adequate evidence of use for URS cases? There were responses there, mostly kind of in the agreement part. And then there's a secondary follow-up question. Again, I'm not really trying to get into the substance here, but just providing the example. And then one last example here, going back to our table, is a little bit further down under the notice, for example, I'm sorry, under the response. Basically, there were about 250 cases up to 2017 where a response was filed, and we needed to do some sort of analysis on that. Now, this one was pretty substantive in that it really touches on all three of our data sources, or really four, the one being Professor Tushnet's coding spreadsheet, two was data collection off of the provider sites that staff had put together, as well as the two sub-teams, practitioners, and providers. So we've already seen the two sub-teams, and this document that I'll be bringing up is going to be familiar to you, but the staff compilation report of URS data, page 16, table 11, URS case review, response analysis. And that has now appeared into the Adobe Connect room. Essentially, it has a summary of initial findings, and then there's a table of data basically parsed out that, you know, was there a response within 14 days? Was the response within 6 months? Or if it was not applicable, meaning that there was no response found or identified in any of the cases that were reviewed. And that is further split apart by the outcome of the URS case, whether it was denied, the domain was suspended, a split decision, or withdrawn. So that's kind of the process on the inventory. Before I start running down the our inventory table, are there any questions or comments about how to navigate through this so that we can start linking data and analysis back to the specific topic that this group and eventually the full working group will want to consider?
Yep, Barry, this is Brian. I just had one question. I don't know if this is exactly what you were asking, but I sense we're sort of getting ready to move on. So I wanted to say my notes on this were where you had the bullets, for example, response and notes, URS provider questions. I think our first task as the document subteam, for most of this column, I put a completed for that. So I think we've identified the sources, the surveys have gone out, that we have answers, and so then it's the question of looking at what do we do with those answers. And then there were two things where I think there's still an open question. One is that final bullet where it says Rebecca's research should show what types of marks are the subject of complaints. So I looked at that this afternoon, and I saw that basically about 50-50 were either identical or the mark plus a term that I'm guessing corresponds to the trademark owner's, you know, area of activity. And so it was a question for us, really, whether the question there on types of marks was to say, and this goes back to the question on the previous page 3, the suggested new question as of ICANN 60, should the first element be modified to include names that are abusively registered but may not be confusingly similar or identical? So I'm guessing that would be something like, you know, fakewatches.com. Should that be within the scope of the URS? And I think, frankly, there's I can't really think of documentation short of, you know, surveying brand owners or maybe some academic research that would help answer that question. It's really a big ticket question for the full working group. So I guess the question is for ourselves, whether that last bullet there on Rebecca's research types of marks, was that meant to be looking at how many are identical, how many are mark plus, or was that meant to be something else? And if it's just something else, which I suspect some people may be interested in, which is, you know, what type of mark, right? Is it arbitrary? Is it suggestive? Is it fanciful? Is it descriptive? That sort of thing. My personal view is that's a really big question, and frankly, I don't know that there's documentation or data that can help us answer that. And I think it's a really thorny issue. I mean, for example, if you had a suggestion that a dictionary term, you know, apple's the easiest example, I think we're gonna end up in a lot of interesting discussion, but not really be able to draw any firm conclusions on whether, you know, a dictionary word, for example, that's an arbitrary mark should be subject of a URS case. So that's my long-winded way of saying, are we good ourselves to say, when we're looking at what types of marks, we're looking at identical versus a mark plus a term, and not getting into this question of, should a dictionary term be subject to a URS complaint when it's a brand used in an arbitrary sense?
Thank you, Brian, and hence why I also highlighted it first as a comment first that, you know, it's something that hasn't been performed yet. I would note that, you know, most of column 4 is based on the prior deliberations of this subteam. I'd have to go through the transcripts way back to figure out who's exactly suggested it. But as you state, I think that is for sure a decision that this subteam should consider as to, you know, is that type of analysis necessary? Does it go back or help answer any of the 5, you know, larger, the higher level questions, the 90,000 foot level questions, which I'll go ahead and just put them out on the record here. Again, these were the 5 high-level questions that Heather had suggested when we were going through the new identification of charter questions, for lack of anything else. But the first is, you know, has it been used? Why or why not? Second was, you know, what's the original purpose? Isn't it being fulfilled? The third, bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? Fourth being, you know, what changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose or facilitate it to carry out its purpose, and what was the ultimate outcome? To your question to the subteam as eventually the large working group, you know, is that some kind of research that we should or shouldn't be doing And certainly staff is not in a position to answer that. And certainly trademarks in general are way outside of my bailiwick. But again, what I did identify here was that Rebecca's coding research did have a few columns in that spreadsheet that had some kind of trademark analysis against it. But I didn't go any further than that.
Maybe can I ask if anyone else on the call has any particular views on that? I mean, do folks agree that we can consider this question answered if we, I looked at her research and 894 were identical, 900 were a mark plus, 21 were a typo, and consider that sufficiently answer the question that was put to us, or do people feel like there's more to unpack in that question?
Hi, this is Rebecca Tashman. I'm really sorry. I'm not able to make my hand go up in Adobe. Can I just say a word?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca Tashnet. I think there are two distinct sets of questions. I think the coding has been very helpful to figure out, you know, what types of URS cases are being brought. That is the, you know, identical mark plus and typo coding. I also think there's a separate, quite live question that the decided cases coding doesn't address at all, which is not, you know, should the process be available to terms like Apple? I don't think anyone thinks they shouldn't. It shouldn't be, but is there a live problem with descriptive terms, especially in the notice context, where, you know, are people trying to register things like hotel, you know, hotel.london, getting notices that deter them when, in fact, there shouldn't be? So I want to keep that on the table without opening the question of, you know, should hotel be eligible at all? I want to know whether there's a problem. Thank you.
Yeah, Rebecca, this is Brian Beckham. I think it's, you know, it's a good question, and certainly we've discussed a lot, you know, the potential chilling effect, you know, in terms of these claims notices. But I think, and I don't think that there's any suggestion to not look into that, but I think that really falls more into the TMCH and the claims notices bailiwick versus the URS.
And John McElwain has his hand up. Please go ahead.
Thanks, John McElwain, for the record. So I was going to say something very similar to what Brian just chimed in on. I just don't see how we could determine whether any particular mark is descriptive or generic. I mean, it necessarily would require looking at what the mark was registered for, and then also looking behind all that to see if, although being descriptive, whether it was still had acquired distinctiveness. I think it's more of an issue with respect to the trademark clearinghouse than it is with respect to the URS. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Okay. Not seeing any additional hands about this. Why don't I do what Brian had mentioned earlier, and let's just run through this entire table real quickly and maybe try to get some agreement that either we did satisfy the data ask or if we didn't, should we go get it, and how do we go about doing that. But before I get started, I see two hands. First, Kathy, please go ahead.
Actually, can I pause? Because I'm still catching up a little bit here, so I'm happy to wait for the other hand.
Okay, no problem. Phil, please go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us still? Now we can't hear you still.
Maybe, this is Brian again, maybe if, Phil, if you can hear us, we can't hear you. I don't know if, Kathy, you wanted to make your comment
sure.
Just while Phil gets back on?
Sure. Thanks, Brian. So apologies for coming in late, everybody. I had a question about whether the documents have shown us clearly or not clearly whether the facts are on the table regarding the trademark. Regarding the trademark, the category of goods and services, the jurisdiction of the trademark. So since this is the document subteam, are the decisions showing that all this information is on the record? Going back to the comment that was taking place when I came in about descriptive terms, do we know, you know, kind of what the context for that evaluation is and whether the facts are on the table. The question's been asked in different places, but from a documents perspective, has an answer been provided? And I apologize if it's already been given.
Thank you, Kathy. So you did miss the first few minutes. Essentially, what we've gone through was really just understanding the inventory here and how it links to the other documents. Our next step is basically just to run through this table and identify whether we do have the data or not, confirm it, know where it's at. If we don't, should we still go get it? And then the next cycle after that is then really to kind of get into the more substantive discussions. In response to your question, and maybe Brian or others can correct me if I'm mistaken, you know, this particular sub-bullet on page 4 of section 1, which is the complaint, was identified by a team member, you know, probably back in February. And to my knowledge, you know, staff hasn't done any kind of research or analysis on the types of marks other than to just point out that there was some coding research performed by Rebecca's team. And really then the question is, you know, does it need to occur, and then if so, and how? So I doubt that was helpful. But Brian, do you want to maybe respond as well?
Yeah, thanks, Barry. This is Brian again. And I think, Kathy, there was one question in the, I believe it was the provider survey, it may have also been in the practitioners, where they were asking some information about the FMV files. And so I think that's one place that maybe we can identify where this question can be examined. And then, you know, to the broader question, if I understand correctly about, you know, if somebody has a, let's say, a descriptive mark or a suggestive mark, what type of evidence are they providing to the panelists, and how does the panelist use that in its decision? I would say, for present purposes, if it's okay with you and everyone, maybe we could put that as a question to come back to at the end of the call once we run through the data. I think it really gets us into that territory of looking at the decisions, and there's a question about, you know, are the panelists fully reflecting the evidentiary record that's put before them in the complaints, in the decisions. If I understood the question correctly, maybe we can recall that there were questions asked about the SMB files to the providers and I believe practitioners, and then there's a question about how are marks that are fall in different places on the strength spectrum addressed in decisions, and come back to that later.
Great point. That sounds great. I'll just add that we do know that the SMD files are coming in encrypted. So all that you can see is the string from the providers and nothing else. So it seems to be a valid question, which I'm happy to come back to, and I think that makes sense. To the documents group, are we seeing, without second-guessing the decisions, are we seeing that the evidence has come in from another source? Do the decisions reflect that there is full information that's come in, presumably from the complaint. But we do know, you know, again, from the provider's question, that, that the information is not coming in from the SMD file. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely, Kathy. And just a super quick follow-up on that. I was a little surprised. We don't, as you know, do the URS, and I was a little surprised in seeing the responses to the survey that apparently the only piece of information that, that someone like a provider could glean from the SMB file was the actual mark and not, for example, the jurisdiction or the goods or services. So that, to be honest, I don't know what the answer to that question is. It seems to be something that may be more a question for Deloitte. You know, in other words, they've got the information. Can they tack that into the SMD file? But I certainly think it's a good question to come back to.
Thank you, Brian. Phil, please go ahead.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Good. Going back to the question of dictionary words, just a couple of comments. These are personal comments. You know, one, the URS has to be available against them because every dictionary word is a trademark for something, and in many cases, trademarks for multiple types of goods and services by different parties. So far as the claims notice, I think our task there is to discern whether the notice that the potential registrant gets is clear and provides them with sufficient information to make a decision on whether to proceed without having to spend lots of money on an attorney. Let me give you an example. And I don't know if they have, but if Microsoft has put Windows in the TMCH for the category, for the goods and services of computer software, and if one potential registrant wants to register Windows.tech for the purpose of spoofing Microsoft and running a phishing or malware site, we want them to be deterred. But if someone else is trying to register Windows.London because they're in the business of installing and repairing glass windows in buildings, we want to make sure that they understand that continuing on to registration is not going to get them in trouble. So I, that, in my mind, is you know, what we should be doing, that it's not a URS issue. It's a claims notice clarity issue, and we can look at that when we get to the claims notice down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Kathy, I still see your hand up. Is that an old hand?
Old hand. Sorry about that. I'll take it down.
Okay. No problem. All right. Thank you. And thank you for the discussion. And again, just to kind of circle back as to why this particular bullet even showed up, it really just kind of circles back to the standing or grounds for filing and not necessarily whether it's related to, you know, a claims notice or anything along those lines. But staff has noted in the notes that we can circle back to that. So I'm going to kind of run through quickly through this entire table, and after I'll basically read out each section, and then I'll pause and see if there are any comments or questions about the data that we have identified, and then we'll hopefully get through this, and then by the end we can perhaps talk about next steps and how do we work from here. So I think we covered the complaint pretty well. Again, three primary sources, the practitioners and the providers' data sources, and a possible, if there is any discussion about trademarks and the types that perhaps Rebecca's research can be utilized there. The second section is the notice, and the subteam had identified basically two sources here. The first, again, was from the providers looking for information about their what their process is on sending a notice and what procedures they have in place regarding non-deliverable messages. So in the provider's questions, there was basically on pages 1 through 3, rows 1 through 8, there are 8 different questions as it relates to
to this particular topic about sending the notice and what do they do if snail mail versus email and those kinds of things. It was kind of difficult for staff to try to extract a summary, but that would be, again, when this group or the larger working group, whichever, gets into the more substantive discussion, it would be good to refer back to these specific rows, read through them on how the providers responded, and then begin those deliberations to form any preliminary conclusions or the like. The second area was basically relating from the registry operator, which was also from the responses or from the provider's questions, again, pages 3 through 4, rows 9 through 12. Essentially, there were some difficulties experienced in communications between the providers and registry operators. There was also some discussion about the duration and the locking of the domain name within 24 hours. Then the second source as it pertains to the notice section are the qualitative experiences about what practitioners had seen regarding issues with notice of complaints. And based on their survey, pages 5 and 6, it looked like there were two survey questions. Basically, most of the practitioners I think there was only one that actually represented a respondent. The rest had represented complainants, and according to those two survey questions, there were no issues identified. So, you know, it's really kind of just one particular view of coming in. So that's the notice section. Kathy, I see your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
I think you can. Okay, so here's where I'm kind of missing the, and again, apologies for not being here when we started. We seem to be dropping all the action-oriented stuff, and maybe that's because it's for another sub-team, but it's, since it's being presented here, how do we preserve it, Barry? Notice, we know it's not going out in the proper languages that it's required by policy. We know it's not going out in all the forms that it's required by policy. We know that some providers are not even bothering with return receipts, even those who only deliver by email. Notice to the registries, we think that's getting through. Notice to the registrars, we think that's not getting through because people are having trouble with extending the, after the suspension, that right to extend for 1 year. The registrars seem to be having problems getting that notice or processing that notice. Can we preserve the action items? Everywhere we talk about this stuff, let's not recreate the wheel. We kind of know what the problems are. How do we preserve them so that every time we talk about this now, we can zero in on what we found, not where it is, but what we found? Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. So again, we're only just doing a high level review of the inventory of data. I'm not really trying to get into the substantive discussion about those. Again, we're identifying, did we get the data? Yes. If we don't have it, do we still need to get it? And if we do need to get it, who and when are we going to get it? And then the next cycle, and I think we'll talk about this more at the end of the call, is when we return to go through this table again, we're going to stop at each section and have that substantive dialogue and capture all the actions that you referred to, or, you know, at least some of the high-level issues that have been identified from the data. And I could envision that when we do that, you know, it's kind of starts off in bulleted form that we identify these different types of issues after we reviewed the data, and that will form the substance of at least some kind of summary document that we can then either present back to the full working group as we, you know, show them the work that has been performed here.
Barry, this is Brian. I want, if I can, just to compliment what you said and try to answer Kathy's question. So I guess if you came on a little after the beginning, what we were recalling was that this particular working group was meant to identify sources where we could find data. And so for this one, for example, in my notes in the margin say that this one is done because we have, for example, the practitioner survey, the register operator responsive, et cetera. And so absolutely to your question about if we have in those surveys, if we have evidence that there's difficulties with communications for whatever reason, then I think what we probably ought to do, and we can discuss this on email or on our chair's call on Friday, is it seems to me like what we need to do is kind of somehow find a way to bring the work that's been done in the different sub-teams together with a view to making recommendations. So for here, where we've identified that notice question, the language question, is something that practitioners and providers and register operators would have information that would be useful on. For the document sub-team, that was really our task, was to identify, who would have the information, where we can find the information, et cetera. I think that really is the big question in front of us. Is we've been gathering a lot of data over the past couple months, and now we need to think about the best way to bring it all together. So just to make that crystal clear, by no means are we proposing to sort of skip the action part of this. It's just we felt that this was not necessarily within the remit of this particular sub-team, and so that's really a question for the broader working group and the chair to think about how we bring this all together.
Thank you, Brian. All right, so let's move. Okay. All right, thank you, Kathy. Let's move on to the response section. Essentially, we identified four sources of data for this particular section. Some of the higher level issues were understanding the duration of the response period or other issues relating to defenses or default procedures, as well as response fees. So the four sources, the first one was reviewing, again, the 250 cases where a response occurred. Earlier in the call, I showed you a brief example, but that's in the staff compilation document of kind of all the data and charts that we've put together to date around the URS cases. I included a little bit of a summary extract from that document. I won't go into the details of it, but when we do circle back on more of the substantive discussion around responses as it relates to the cases, we've got that data source there. The second one is to review cases where there were 15 or more domains that contain to determine any issues as it relates to response fees. So here, I believe it came from two areas, and I probably didn't do a good enough job. Yes, I did. First, it came from the provider survey, and a forum had identified, I believe it was six cases. Yes, where there were 15 or more domains, as well as, that data is also from our raw extract of the cases where we were able to find that as well. But there were six cases as it relates to 15 or more domains. I couldn't find any specific information as it related to fees, but predominantly because all six of these cases, there was no response. So likely there was no response fee paid on those. Third source of data was qualitative experiences when communicating to registries about getting the domain locked within 24-hour period. Again, this came from the providers section. I'm referring really back up above to section A. That's kind of where it talks about interactions with registries. And then the fourth data source was qualitative experiences from registries about receiving notices from providers. Were these sent through the appropriate channels, or did they contain the correct information? So this one is still outstanding, and, I'm not sure about how we go about getting that other than perhaps creating a very small or simple survey that staff could send to through the RYSG or through the registry contacts through GDD if the group still feels it's necessary. So those are the four basic high-level data sources for this section. Any questions or comments before we move on to the next one?
Yeah, Barry, this is Brian. I had one just comment was I had the same summary, which was this was all concluded except for that question to the register operators. And my question was how we can do that. One idea just off the top of my head is, and I'm happy to help out with this, we can find out, you know, what are the top, you know, five or six registries that have URS cases filed. So, for example, if it's dot whatever, then we could try to reach out, you know, directly to those register operators rather than through the full registry stakeholder group, because a lot of those people wouldn't have had experience with cases.
Understood. Yeah. Thank you, Brian. Any other? So it sounds like this is probably still an outstanding item that we might want to put some attention to. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Moving on to the next section. Section D is standard of proof. Essentially, the subteam here identified three sources. First, again, the practitioners was qualitative experiences on how they thought the standard of proof was applied, noting that there wasn't clear agreement among this particular subteam, but the question was still posed to the practitioners subteam. There were, from the practitioner surveys, there was URS use for clear-cut cases, page 14 and 11 of the 14 agree that it was being used for clear-cut cases. There was on page 17 a particular question about guidance on clear and convincing evidence that was a split result. And again, we'll come back into these in detail. But in short, there were probably seven or eight particular survey questions from the practitioners. I'm sorry, the practitioner subteam that kind of relate back to this standard of proof. And then the second area document source was to review the 58 cases where a respondent prevailed, in particular in relation to the grounds defenses mentioned in the URS procedures section 5758 to determine how the respondent prevailed and if not under what grounds. This one has started. I did add kind of a draft summary of data in the staff compilation report on pages 17 to 21. So there were 59 cases, it turns out, not 58. 31 of those didn't have a response at all. And then the other 28 did. And so we might want to look into those a little bit in greater detail. What I wound up doing was creating a pivot table out of Rebecca's coding spreadsheet. When her team went through and coded, they would basically identify which of the three prongs or other, whether it was satisfied or not in the URS case. And then they also provided kind of freeform text to understand what other defenses might have been used for that respondent to prevail in that case. And I've highlighted those in that document, or at least extracted it as it relates to these 28 cases where a response was indeed filed. And when we look at those in closer detail in the more substantive deliberations, you know, that'll help inform this question. You know, were the defenses mentioned in 5758 adequate enough, or do we need to look at adding to as well? The last also source for this is within Rebecca's coding spreadsheet, there is a response argument analysis that's kind of just a different way of what I put into our draft staff compilation data document. Just kind of a different view of trying to get to the same answers. So we can also refer back to that. And then lastly, there was also a suggestion for a possible working group recommendation to develop an examination guide for examiners to understand distinction between easy versus hard cases. I suspect Brian will want to speak to this. He sent an email to the list. Again, just to note that, you know, this particular bullet, as some of the others, was just staff's attempt at trying to capture the deliberations of earlier sub-team meetings. So the wording here is very loose and draft. And anyway, it's one of the areas of a possible recommendation that might want to be put forward, at least for the larger working group to consider. So I'll stop there. And Brian, would you like to respond to this?
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Just the one comment that I had was, first of all, I had noted a to-do and need the volunteer on the work in progress on comment BC4 there. And then on the comment MW5, I had marked that as done. We've added that to the list of questions for the providers. Probably the more interesting question is the suggestion for a possible working group recommendation to develop an examination guide to understand distinction between easy and hard cases. I was trying to understand where that came from. I know we had discussed a kind of a checklist of the minimum elements, and I've looked at the provider responses, and I know that they had some reservations about kind of how to decide which cases are easy or simple or that sort of thing. So it's really a question for us as a sub-team and a working group, you know, whether we agree that it's sufficient to propose a recommendation that we provide some sort of a checklist of the minimum elements that should be in the URS decision, and so my suggestion would be to not get into the more thorny question of should that guide try to help examiners distinguish between easy and difficult cases, you know, noting especially the provider's responses on that. So that's the question for the sub-team here.
Thank you, Brian. David, your hand's raised. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. David McCauley speaking for the record. I saw Brian's email, and I certainly thought it was very insightful. I just wanted to speak up because I may have been the source for this idea of a checklist or a guide, but I never spoke of a guide in terms of being able to identify or to deal with difficult versus easy cases. I don't know where that idea came from. And I saw that in Brian's mail there was a little bit of pushback from some of the examiners who are experienced, and I can understand that. But it seems to me that the idea, when we get to it, the idea of a checklist for maybe new examiners, or, you know, or simply to somehow prompt them to speak, to explain at least, how they deal with the elements rather than rendering a decision that simply says the complaint is successful would be a good one. At least addressing the elements of URS, you know, that there was a valid mark, that the respondent had no right in the mark, and that it was registered and used in bad faith. So I like that idea. I don't know where this idea, the easy versus hard, and getting into that kind of a discussion came from. So hopefully we can come to something useful in the end at the working group level. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you, David. And I recall your comments in Panama to that point as well. Any other questions or comments as it relates to this section? And I'd also note that there is a section towards the bottom about education, and perhaps that's a better location for some kind of checklist or guide or whatever it might be when we get back to the substantive discussions. Okay, moving on, we've got 25 minutes left. Section E is the defenses. Essentially, this was looped together with the previous section, at least in general, the same types of data were kind of identified and married together. I think when we get to the more substantive discussions, you know, after we have reviewed the previous section, we will maybe want to expand on defenses and just make sure that we've got that area covered. Let's go ahead and move on to remedies, section F.
This is Brian. Sorry, just for one super quick interruption. I did actually go on the NAF website this afternoon, and I searched. They had no URS cases where the term latches appeared, and 6 where the term delay appeared. So just wanted to you know, get that information into the document.
Thank you, Brian. And did you happen to make your edits into this Word document by chance, or did you print it and write it?
No, I did these actually all by hand, but what I'm happy to do is maybe if you and I wanted to have a quick call, or I can just do it on a document that just to sort of incorporate the notes that I've jotted in the margins, whatever is most efficient for you and I and everybody, I'm happy to do.
I think it'll be best maybe just put it into bulleted form, page number, bullet number, and then I'll add it to the master and put the note that, you know, that it came from you. Okay, so again, section F, remedies. There were six sources here. First, from the provider's qualitative experiences relating to the scope and duration of remedies. From the provider's questionnaire or from their discussions of the rules and procedures, page 25, rows 105 through 108 had some information in there. There was also qualitative experiences on implementation of remedies, found some information from the same provider's questions on page 25 as well as rows 105 through 108. The third bullet here, the URS document subteam to review IRT and STI reports to document origin. Mary had noted that this was a staff action item, and so this one is still outstanding, and we'll circle about that. I think the idea there was just to understand if maybe kind of perform a high-level gap analysis between what the IRT and STI came up with versus what is actually loaded into the current rules and procedures. The fifth area, basically to review the domain life cycle after suspension of those cases where the complainant prevailed. I think probably the use of the term domain life cycle is not as accurate. More recently I've been utilizing or using the term disposition. So basically on the staff compilation report of data, pages 11 through 13, tables 8 and 9, there's analysis of the URS cases where the claim was denied. I omitted one. So I will add that there should be a third sub-bullet here. Again, the domain disposition, essentially what we wound up doing, we did the first attempt with the Rebecca spreadsheet, and I provided UIS data. However, that was just a snapshot of older records, so it wasn't as useful of a snapshot, a more current query of UIS information, but essentially we made the determination of whether the domain was still suspended, whether it had been recovered by the brand, or whether it's available for registration. But that analysis does exist in the staff compilation report, as well as these two that I have identified here about where the claim was denied. And Rebecca's coding spreadsheet also has a tab on denied claims analysis. And coming out of that domain disposition analysis, which I briefly pointed to in our previous subteam call, I had noticed that there were two cases filed against the same domain name at different times, and there's also a table in that document that will show that comparison. And we have some great music. Andrea, any chance you can isolate that line?
Yeah, I'm checking on it.
All right, great. Thank you. And then the last two areas, which one hasn't been started, which again is we should maybe circle back to the ENTA survey for any relevant information. as it relates to these. And then lastly, we're awaiting the final report from the CCP review team that may have some information that's relative there. As I understand, there hasn't been a lot of changes from the proposed recommendations of their previous report that they launched for public comment, but they're mostly updating the context and content around some of those recommendations. Again, that's still outstanding. All right, any questions or comments about remedies for Section F?
Barry, this is Brian. I just wanted to say I actually looked earlier at the INTIS survey and the CCT report, so I'm happy to feed that information to you to bring that up to speed.
Great. Send it to the list, and I'll be glad to add it. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right, moving right along into the appeals section. This was easy because there were only 14 appeals. We did identify three data sources. Staff did an initial analysis of the 14 appeals. That's in the staff compilation report. There's also a spreadsheet that has the actual details of that analysis, essentially kind of looking under the hood of the summary findings that are included in the staff compilation report. The second source was to review cases where de novo review occurred. Again, this kind of goes back to the response analysis and identifying that of the 827 cases, 30 of those cases had a response within 6 months, which is the de novo review. Other than identifying those, we didn't get into any of the more further analysis at looking at each one of those cases, but it should be noted that all of those 30 cases, there were 6 that were denied. And again, we can show that in greater detail when we get into substantive discussions. The other source from the U.S. providers questions on page 28 and 29, rows 128 through 132, as well as some information also found on the practitioner survey as it relates to appeals. Any questions about that particular section?
Barry, this is Brian. Just one quick comment. I searched on the NAF site today, and it looked like there were 10 cases that were subject of a de novo review. So I'm happy to provide a list of those and a link to the decision, and maybe if we could have a volunteer to kind of do a quick look at those and see if there's any recommendations that we wanted to filter up to the sub-team and the working group, that would be really helpful.
Definitely great. I would be interested in that because I think that's been one of the challenges when I was looking through the data, especially in as it relates to this response analysis. You know, so there's some kind of delta between the 30 that I found with, you know, where there was indeed a response within the 6 month window versus the 10 that you found that were truly tagged as de novo review. So it'd be interesting to understand the difference between those. So definitely send that to the list, and I can at least take an initial crack at understanding what that is. And thank you, David, for volunteering as well. Okay, moving on to Section 8, potentially overlapping process steps. Some of this kind of starts to get a little fuzzy. Basically, here the sub-team had referred back to Section C, for reviewing the 250 responses. We may want to take some time to look at this in detail and understand whether Section H is as necessary or not anymore. It also mentioned something about the appeal, but in terms of this section, I didn't identify any particular data other than reference back to Section C. Moving along to costs, there were few sources identified here. First, from the practitioners looking for the qualitative experiences on the average cost to prosecute or defend a proceeding. There was a comment here that I believe Mary had highlighted that was completed. What I failed to do, though, is identify where that's located. So either I couldn't find it or I accidentally overlooked it, and I will go back and make sure that that one gets inventoried correctly. Second area was from the provider's feedback on filing fees, and we did find some information on pages 9 and 10. And then, again, also looking back at the INTA survey for any results relating to fees and cost, and that one hadn't been started yet. Any questions or comments on that one? One other thing that I'll notice that was very helpful about how this subteam had structured its work by these sections, for example, Section J language, you'll notice that in the provider subteam, you know, there's easily 30 pages of tables in there, but what makes it handy is they're using the same structure that we have here. So it's a lot easier to kind of marry the two different subteams' approach of their work by these particular topics. So that was definitely very helpful. So language, there were two sources identified here. First, from the providers and any of their qualitative experiences on feedback. We did find something on pages 18 and 20. And then from the practitioners, I don't believe I found anything from the practitioner survey as it related to the survey. So we may need to do a little bit more fact-finding for that one. I do know that the providers had very substantive responses as it related to language, so perhaps that might be enough. And then there's a couple other notes here from ICANN 61. I won't go into the details of those. And I feel like I'm rambling a lot, but we're almost done. So Section K, abuse of process. Basically,
Barry, sorry, this is Brian. I just had one really quick question on the question of notice. Does anyone recall if this was notification of the commencement of a case to the registrar operators, or in the ERP context, we ask them to clarify certain information, you know, so the identity of the registrar. So we're just wondering if we knew which one or both of those that this question was meaning to address?
I'm not seeing any hands or comments. My understand that the notice section was the notice sent to the respondent or the registrant, and not so much about the notice of the suspending the domain to the registry operator, but I'm not sure if I really understood your question, though.
Well, so the question says, suggestion from ICANN 61 for full working group consideration. Recommendation that the providers use the same language for notices sent to both the registrar operator and the registrar with respect to the same complaint. So we're just trying to understand, you know, what communication was that? Was that the communication that a case exists, that the domain name needs to be locked, that they're seeking confirmation of the registrant's identity, et cetera?
This is Barry. My apologies. I had skipped over that bullet. I believe that is the suspension notice to the registry operator. Yes, and Mary is correct that she believes that was an observation from Maxim when we went through this a while back in the larger working group at ICANN 61. And as Mary notes in the chat, was referring to inconsistencies in practice when a language other than English is involved. Okay, so again, moving on to abuse of process. This subteam didn't identify any data sources as it related to, and I believe that when this subteam had discussed it, there had already been information provided by the providers that there had been no abuses reported to the centralized abuse database. And thus we didn't really identify any other particular sources. However, we were maybe going to revisit this question depending on the results of the 59 cases where the claim was denied. But I did also as well find some information in the URS providers questions table on page 27 that will rows 122 to 126 that will also maybe provide some information as it relates to abuse of the process. And we've got 8 minutes left. Education and training. Basically, this one is still outstanding in reviewing the provider websites to see what information is currently provided. And then I also did find information both from the providers table on page 22 and pages 14 and 18 that may be useful here. And lastly is section M, URS providers. I think one, the first one is outstanding. Again, to review the ICANN websites for what information is available. And then the secondary one is also from the providers. And I did find, again, on page 29, row 136, that may respond to this as well. So that's a walk through the table. Sorry, that took a little bit longer than I wanted. And I will turn it back to Brian. Maybe for the next 7 minutes, we can talk about next steps and then move from there and convene for the day. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. So this is Brian. I think this was really useful. So I think we've identified but for most of these, as far as the documents, sorry, that's the people on the airport watching the World Cup behind me, that I think for the bulk of these, we were finished with our task as the document subteam in terms of identifying sources of data, and we had a few where we identified need to do a little bit deeper digging, and we have a few volunteers to tackle those. So for me, the question is, at our next, if we have a call next week as a subteam, if we have the to-do items actions and discuss those, and then maybe if I know Phil and Kathy are on the call, we can discuss on Friday, you know, to what extent do we want to within this subteam or, you know, within the context of another subteam. I think there's been a general recognition that these have been pretty efficient ways of working. If we want to identify whether it's this document subteam pulling together some recommendations or whether we wanted to sort of recalibrate and see whether it's useful to think about another subteam to kind of look at pulling together all of the different work streams that have been going on in the different subteams, if we want to do that as a full working group, if we want to do that as co-chairs with staff. So for me, I think just to recap, it's on the one hand to note that we've completed most of our tasks as the document subteam. We have a few outstanding items. We have some volunteers. We'll circulate the information we discussed today on the email list and come back next week, if that's agreeable to everyone, just to sort of cap off the document subteam. And then I think what we really need is to sort of have a steer from the broader working group or the co-chairs with the staff to see, you know, where do we go from here as either this subteam or a reconvened subteam in terms of pulling together the different recommendations and observations that we have across the different subteams to recommendations for the broader working group. I know Phil and Kathy are on the call. Does that sound like an efficient path forward to you all and also to the people that are on the call on the subteam?
Uh, Thank you, Brian. I'm not seeing any hands in the window. I note that Kathy is not in the Adobe Connect room. She still could be on audio. Phil, did you want Phil is typing into the chat. Griffin and David McCauley and Phil all say they sound generally okay to me in terms of the approach.
And this is Kathy. I'm still on the call, although I've been blown out of the Adobe Connect room. And it sounds like a good approach. I'd still love to see that kind of action-oriented, you know, before we create another sub-team, kind of what is it that's rising to the top that, you know, people see as you know, as, what does each sub-team see as falling outside, that's something that they've highlighted that's falling outside of what they expected to find. And so I think the more action-oriented, the more concerns or issues that we get, the faster who, you know, as co-chairs or a new sub-team or whatever, the faster we'll be able to sort through. But at this point, everyone's an expert. So what's, you know, what's rising to the top, what's percolating up is the issues and concerns. Thanks.
Yeah, Kathy, this is Brian. I completely agree. I think, and so this is what I was kind of suggesting, that maybe on our co-chairs call we can discuss what's the best way to pull together all the work that's been going on in the sub-teams in the most efficient way, if it's in the full working group, if it's in a new sub-team. But I think that's something we really just need to kind of, you know, brainstorm a little bit and see what we think is best.
Agreed.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian. Like I said, we'll get notes and action items sent out. Definitely invite everybody on the list. It does take a while, but I think it will be very insightful to spend the time to go through each of those sections, find the link, go to that document, try to understand the table chart or responses that you see. If there are questions, please send them to the list, and I'll try to provide clarification at least for the data that staff provided and put that in context. And then we'll, as Brian said, there's a chairs meeting on Friday. We'll understand what the scheduling is going to look like next week. And it does sound like this subteam will at least meet once more before we return back to the working group. So we'll get that on your calendars as soon as possible. So thank you, everyone, for joining. Have a good day, and go England.
Thanks a lot, Barry.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. Please remember to disconnect all lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.